Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a Pulitzer Prize-winning American investigative journalist. Born in New York City, he earned his degree in philosophy at the age of just 15. While still a teenager, he also served as a UNICEF spokesperson for youth, advocating for children and women caught up in the Darfur crisis in Sudan. In 2009, at 22 years old, he became a special advisor to the Obama administration, then a Rhodes Scholar, earning his PhD in political science at Magdalen College, Oxford. It was his work detailing the allegations of sexual misconduct against the movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, published in The New Yorker, that situated my guest in the centre of the global spotlight, however. His reporting has had profound effects, both within the film industry and further afield. And yet, through all of this, video games have been a constant. "I love video games," he told The New York Times in 2021. Big nerd here. Welcome, Ronan Farrow.
Hey, Simon. A long-time listener, first-time caller. It's not literally listener, I'm thinking of your articles, but it's nice to talk to someone who's so thoughtful about the medium.
That's very kind of you to say. So, I mean, Ronan, you're an unusually accomplished person, I would say. That intro could probably have been many times longer and still only covered some of what you've achieved in your young life. Some people might wonder how you've had the time to fit video games into that high-achieving lifestyle.
Well, I think, as with so many things, video games became a deep living part as an act of rebellion against rules barring video games in the house. You know, I grew up in such a kind of square household in some ways, chaotic and crazy and colorful in other ways. But you know, my mom was a real stickler for, like, you start with classical music, no rock and roll until you really understand the historical roots that preceded that.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, like, you do your Russian novels before you get to Super Mario Brothers. So I became a really dreadful snob at an early age, very well versed in all the arguments that video games are an art form, capital A, capital F, and And I don't know that I sold people around me on that argument, but I did then get very into art games from an early point. And I think part of that was like a technical exigency. Because I wasn't allowed to have a console, I think the agreement I finally wheedled out of my mom was that when I turned 16, I could get a console, something like that.
Wow.
15 or 16. But up until then, I experienced games as a PC, more literally a Mac gamer. And then through emulating N64 games and Super Nintendo games and so forth. So the first cornerstone being computer-driven rather than console-driven really did shape my taste. Like, you know, at that point in time, especially now, it's much more uniform because everything's ported everywhere. But on the computer, you had things like, you know, Myst and even something like Prince of Persia is like pretty intricate compared to the platformers that predominated at the time on consoles. So I got a lot more into, I guess, what the forebears of modern walking simulators and puzzle games, as opposed to the more of the kinetic running and jumping games.
And were you sort of playing those computer games when you were supposed to be reading Tolstoy?
Oh my God, yeah. I started college young, as you mentioned. So I was like fully in an academic phase where I needed to be more focused on school than other people my age. And yet I was like staying up until, you know, 4 a.m. before rolling out of bed to run to class playing, you know, Diablo 2, learning about life and cruelty by having people, you know, scam me out of my Stones of Jordan. That's the cornerstone of the Diablo 2 economy. For any listeners out there who are familiar.
I read, one of the first times I personally learned that you played video games was when you did you posted something to social media. This is a few years ago. It was a post about Animal Crossing Wild World. I don't know if you remember this.
I do.
You were referring to a character in that game called Sable the Seamstress, who was like an elderly hedgehog, I think. And if you sort of talk to her a few times, she eventually opens up and tells you the story about Tom Nook, who's the monopolist raccoon in the Animal Crossing world. And you wrote, and she tells you all about how, you know, before he was an evil capitalist, she used to, you know, she used to have some good times with him and all that. And you wrote that this little vignette about a woman's heartbreak is buried in a game that's mostly about catching bugs. You only hear it if you're patient and persistent and give her a lot of space to open up. Really lovely post. And I think the implication was that, you know, this is maybe how you approach your sources. I'm not suggesting that Harvey Weinstein's downfall was aided by this rather arcane bit of Animal Crossing backstory, but also was it?
I think I probably in some recess of my mind was aware of the link between that and that kind of thing of dialogue trees in sort of more cerebral narrative games and what I do for a living, which does involve a lot of like patient and careful excavating of stories. You know, games are a medium that can do that kind of excavation-driven, almost archaeological storytelling differently and perhaps better than books or movies. So I think, you know, games that really lean on environmental storytelling, like, you know, the Myst series, where you have like a whole world and body of art direction that is supposed to teach you about a character's psychology. I mean, that was in a very simplistic form in that the first game in that series, and they then iterated on that. And then also things like, you know, in the present day, a lot of FromSoft's work, which, you know, can be arcane as hell to piece together. Sometimes who knows if it all even hangs together once you actually do watch every Vati Vidya plot explainer. But they do a tremendous job of building atmosphere and even some character, you know, just through stuff you pick up with careful observation. So yeah, I think Animal Crossing, low-key being like a stunning piece of character-driven writing under the surface, is totally fascinating to me. And I really love that kind of storytelling. I think it's a pleasure that you only really get in video games.
So, Ronan, the format of the podcast is I've asked you to pick the five video games you want to put on your ideal games machine. And you've chosen, your first game is a computer game title, as we might expect from what you said there, from 1997. Can you tell us, what is this game and why did you love it?
I'm otherwise maybe going to struggle to remember how I ranked things, because I had so much trouble choosing. I think we're going chronologically, and I think you're talking about Ribbon, which is apropos of what I just mentioned. So Ribbon was really foundational to me in a lot of ways. It came right at the right time for that love of computer games and puzzle adventure narrative games that we just talked about to kind of burgeon and mature. And it came at the tail end of this giant hype cycle, because at the time Myst, its predecessor, was, you know, the best-selling computer game of all time, and it had really mainstreamed the adoption of CD-ROM drives. I think it's pretty commonly thought that it was a big building block for that technology, and it was doing things that you could only do with that technology, and you needed a lot of storage for these very pretty images. And then they disappeared for 4 years and made this, like, you know, no budgetary limitations sequel. And it's often really fun in any medium to witness people coming off of the back of a success like that.
Right, right.
Auteurs in particular. And this one was kind of an auteur-driven thing, right? Famously, the Myst games were made by these two brothers in Spokane, Washington. And, like, you know, they were on the cover of Wire. And they were kind of computer game folk heroes for a brief moment there. And I actually recently did a voice acting role in a game that they produced, just because I love their stuff so much that they knew that if they, like, slid into the DMs and said, hey, we've got this experimental VR game. It was a VR game directed not by Rand Miller, he was a producer on it, but by the couple that made That Dragon Cancer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I had really admired that game too, so I did this voice acting role for them.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of things coming full circle, because I had spent my childhood immersed in Cyan's games. This company founded by these brothers, and I do just love these creative moments where someone comes off the back of a giant success that it, you know, they're dealing with the pressure of, is it going to be lightning in a bottle, and they just go all out creatively without limitation. Mm-hmm. and that can backfire horribly. People can get unrestrained and undisciplined in ways that don't work creatively. But Riven is a game that's really interesting because it doesn't pander at all to the audience. And it did, I think, a very futuristic thing design-wise. It's not a game world where you encounter puzzles in it, like the original Myst, or especially something like The Witness, which Jonathan Blow often cites Myst as big inspiration. So those games are very kind of interrelated. But those are all games where you kind of have discrete puzzles, and then you have the world and the plot. Riven really made the plot, the puzzles, and the world itself, and the characters all kind of one thing. Like, you're exploring one big non-linear, probably more what you'd call like a kind of like a Metroidvania style hub world that you're gradually pushing out into and accessing more areas of in all directions, rather than a true open world. But it's pretty giant to this day. And there's never a moment where you're kind of self-consciously in a puzzle. It really is all, the basic framework is it's a plot about colonialism and daddy issues. So, like, of course I love the plot. And it really is like the puzzles and challenges you encounter feel like an organic extension of this character that's sort of ruling this world. And you're like going through his underwear drawer essentially and reading his journals and stuff to really get a deep sense of character portraiture. And the other thing it does, which is interesting, is it's kind of, the whole game is kind of like two or three puzzles. And I think I put on this list Outer Wilds, which we'll get to later since we're going chronologically, which is really interesting to me because it's one of the few games that I have no idea if the Outer Wilds guys, like, actually consciously emulated the tradition that Myst built. But Riven and Outer Wilds really do a very similar and very unusual thing, which is like the whole world is just a couple of big puzzles, and the puzzles are very narrative driven. And I think that's incredible. And it makes the design hold up so well because it's so not gamey. And props to them, because a lot of the scuttle, I mean, I think it sold very well at the time, but a lot of the scuttlebutt around it at the time was like, it's just too hard. It's just too, they plop you in a world. The storytelling is all very oblique and there's no hand holding at all. You just kind of wander and study the environment and culture until you sincerely have enough knowledge accumulated to advance further. These are like knowledge-based Metroidvanias. Yeah. Which I think is an underexplored tradition in game design.
Very interesting. Yeah, I think people can bounce off them because, like you say, there's not like characters running around and things like that. Uh-uh. And it's all sort of, they're quite sterile is maybe the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's a sort of sterile feel to them, and you have to put a lot of work in yourself. It strikes me that's not too dissimilar from some of the work you do now in your real life, sort of piecing together. You've got these very large, complex puzzles that you're trying to work through with few handholds on the way.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it quite in those terms, but it is true that, like, it's the least shocking thing, right, that an investigative reporter is super into investigative video games.
So let's come back to your story there. You said that your mum was pretty anti-video games, but she said you could get one when you were 16. Was she true to her word?
She was.
So what did you get?
I got a GameCube.
GameCube, lovely.
GameCube was my inaugural. I had, as I mentioned, been emulating N64 games for years prior to that. So I had gotten acquainted with, and Super Nintendo games before that. So I kind of, I knew and loved like the Zelda canon, for instance. I think I always tended to gravitate on the console side, maybe because of those PC gaming roots or Mac gaming roots, towards either more cerebral or at least more exploration-driven games. Like, I'm not really an old-school gamer. I don't particularly enjoy the true arcade-y model of, like, you're running a level over and over again to get higher points and improve your technique. I almost never respond deeply to that. I respond deeply to games that have a component of that that supports something else. Like, I came really close to putting Returnal on this list because I think it's one of the most extraordinary games that I've played in years and years. I think the storytelling is so sophisticated and personal and intimate, and the fact that it's anchored by a, you know, middle-aged woman protagonist is incredible. Although, boy, is she fit as a fiddle for any age, any gender. That lady, like, does not skip leg day.
No, she is
running and jumping and boosting. And that's obviously a very kind of skill-driven game where you have to have complete focus, and, like, how you map the controls and what every finger is doing simultaneously is very, very important. But the things that make me love that game are that, you know, the ways in which the fluid, skill-driven gameplay supports exploration, which feels meaningful because of the Metroidvania component, and plot, which is quite sophisticated in that case, in my view. And also, you know, in that case, it's a social game. So things like Diablo, or, like, I love, you know, Smash Brothers. That was kind of a fixture of my childhood once I got that GameCube. Those games have another function, which is they really do facilitate camaraderie and, like, good times with hopefully good people. And if anyone out there has Returnal and hasn't cracked open the co-op, it's one of the most sensational co-op modes I've ever played. It's crazy that this super, super dense, sophisticated game is, like, completely co-opable all the way through. And it's really a blast to run someone through it. All to say, and I typically not as much a kind of skill-based arcade-y gamer. And I got my GameCube and, of course, was, like, much more into the tradition of, like, Zelda and the 3D Marios, you know, 64 through Odyssey, as opposed to the kind of Mario Brothers series through Mario World through Galaxy, where it's more you're, like, going down a linear corridor and trying to get your technique better.
Yeah, and the GameCube had Wind Waker on it, the Zelda. Lovely cel-shaded Wind Waker, which was...
Uh-huh. And technically Twilight Princess.
Right.
I actually played the GameCube version, where they mirrored the world because the... Oh, well, I guess the GameCube version, the Wii version they mirrored it and made Link a righty, to the consternation of lore buffs. But I think I played the GameCube version, which was still the, you know, as artistically intended left-hand version.
Amazing. I don't know if it, I mean, for me, it, during my childhood, there were definitely times when games were a refuge, I suppose, somewhere. So I sort of retreated. I don't know much about your childhood, but I know that you had lots of siblings because your mum adopted lots, and I guess that was happening when you were that age. Did video games fulfill that function for you? Were they sort of a place that you could find a bit of peace and quiet in?
That's interesting. I mean, you know, you're probably as capable as of armchair psychologizing me as I am myself. It sounds pretty plausible, you know, and my childhood was in some ways, a crucible of a fair amount of turmoil and trauma. Also some really wonderful opportunity and a lot of love and stuff. So I tend to focus on the good in it as much as possible, but there's definitely also tough stuff to, excavate over a lifetime of therapy. And I suppose all of our choices on how we spend time as kids are informed by that kind of refuge seeking, right? Unless you're one of the mythical people that had a well-adjusted childhood, which I wish for you and everyone else. I definitely consciously experienced games just more as like a joyous thing that felt it artistically and creatively and socially enriching. You know, I was very fascinated by the ways in which the medium felt different from other artistic and creative mediums, and the kind of the merger of some qualities of an art form and some qualities of a toy and the technological component, which I was always sort of nerdily drawn to. I mean, you know, I watched like every hour long Digital Foundry video on ray tracing. I'm that guy. I'm really like deeply annoying to play games with because I just want to like sort of stop and look at the like, you know, materials work. Like, look at the shaders.
Well, with that in mind, why don't we come to your second choice here, which is from the year 2000, a game that they called an immersive sim. Can you tell us about this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of the daddies of the immersive sim genre. I picked Deus Ex. There's a running joke on like nerd, you know, corners of Reddit that every time someone mentions Deus Ex, someone reinstalls it somewhere in the world.
Right.
And it is like it's a game that has that quality and the design blueprint of that game is so incredibly forward looking. I think it has that in common with Rhythm, where they kind of did things years before other people were doing them in ways that when they show up now are still impressive to me. So you know, the fact that Deus Ex really embraces this level design philosophy that I guess came from Warren Spector, and he's talked about it a lot publicly. God, you should get him on this podcast. I find that guy fascinating. But, you know, he's embraced this idea that you can make a single city block size level more interesting than, you know, the biggest open world by dint of density of detail. And that's the design philosophy I tend to resonate with most deeply when I encounter it in games. I really want to feel meaningful story and art development and kind of level design that encourages exploration in an intricate way every minute that I'm experiencing an inch of game world. So I tend to specifically not respond to open worlds as much. Breath of the Wild, I think, broke that mold a little for me because it feels, again, I have no idea whether this is a tradition that, you know, was like actually discussed consciously at Nintendo, or they tend to, I think, do their own thing. But it was it's been talked about that it has a lot of traits of the immersive sim genre.
Right.
So the kind of Deus Ex principle of, like, maybe you're finding a vent and sneaking in, or maybe you're stacking boxes and kind of using the physics engine to get around a problem, or maybe you're, you know, using this combat technique, that combat technique. That's very in the bones of Breath of the Wild, and sort of why I find the open world in that game much more tolerable, because it's much more a playground for active engagement and exploration. But to this day, I don't know that anyone has done that better than the original Deus Ex.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoy some of the reboot entries in that series, but they're all kind of unable to restrain themselves from pandering a little too much. And maybe just through the way the economics of pretty realistic looking games have evolved, aren't really capable, it seems, of that scope of ambition. So they feel a little more on the rails, a little more hand-holding.
Yeah.
But that it's exhilarating. I remember as a teenager, like, doing that first, the Liberty Island opening level of Deus Ex, like, over and over and over again in a million different ways. And the fact that it's a game where you can still discover, you know, 20 years later, like, oh, there's a snippet of dialogue that reflects this thing that you might have done or not in the first 5 minutes of the game, and only shows up 20 hours later.
Yeah, what an achievement. Incredible game. Yeah, and I think you're right to draw a link between that and Breath of the Wild, because they both share this. They've got some very low-level rules, which then, like you say, with the physics engine and things like that, which then just allow the player to devise their own solutions in ways that perhaps hadn't been, you know, foreseen by the designers, which makes you feel special and clever and all of that good stuff as well. So
it creates a much more active relationship with the game.
Right.
And you know, the antithesis of that is, like, I much respect to, you know, the many talented artists that work on these games, but I tend to really bounce off of, like, the super hand-holdy corridor games. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've played the first 5 hours of that. Was it 2016 or 2018 God of War reboot?
Right.
And it's such a collection of kind of hand-holding, big-budget tropes. Like, the principle is, we want your engagement with this game to be as frictionless as possible. Which, in function, you know, so it's everything from, like, aggressive giant prompts, the camera tilting against your will towards, like, you walk into a room, it ain't Rivet, you know, it's not like complicated character driven puzzles. You're in a little narrow corridor, you walk into one room and then another, you kill three monsters, and then before you can explore at all, you know, the sidekick character is like, look, a button, you better throw your axe at it. And it's like every room is like that.
Right.
And it's the most popular thing ever. You know, I won, like, all these Game of the Year awards. So there is a really different design tradition that people just love. And they really like to not be challenged. I feel like there's someone out there who's, like, really going to be a defender of that series and going to get super mad at me for this and say, like, it's actually so deep and sophisticated. And maybe it is, but that element of unsophistication is such a turnoff for me every time. And I think, like, I can tolerate that sometimes if a game's other qualities are engaging enough or outside the box of what's expected enough that I still feel that, like, even if there are pandery elements of the framework and it holds your hand a lot, I still feel that kind of electric charge of vision. Like, I do, you know, the God of War reboots we're talking about are obviously really, really consciously emulating Naughty Dog's games. But, like, the thing is, Naughty Dog's games try to do uncomfortable things with storytelling. They try to put you outside of your comfort zone a little. And the actual combat, when you go through that corridor of linear rooms, at least tries as hard as it can around the margins of that, the hand-holding linear framework, to give you some more sandboxy elements. So I love the Deus Ex framework. I really lament the fact that doing that requires so much kind of time and effort and money and attention to detail, and that there seems to be pretty minimal economic incentives for that.
Yeah, although to be fair, I think, you know, the God of War style of Naughty Dog way is expensive as well. So it's just where you're putting your money,
massively,
isn't it?
Massively,
yeah.
It's expensive, but the difference is there is massive economic incentive for it. It's the AAA template of the moment. The other, you know, the kind of Deus Ex design principle seems to be both expensive and, like, broadly unpalatable to people commercially. But I don't, you know, I wonder, like, Yeah, maybe just always. I was kind of going to go down the rabbit hole of what is a, like, a giant hit that mainstreams that genre look like, but I don't know. It might be that, like, the reason that people love that genre is because it's a little, like, fussy and intimidating.
Yeah.
But that's part of the pleasure that you can't take out of it.
Yeah, it's for an audience who likes to tinker and all of that sort of thing, which isn't everyone.
Yeah.
That's good. While you were ranting about God of War, Ronan, I thought if ever you launched a YouTube channel, you would have such a toxic comment section.
Oh, my God. I mean, the thing is, like, I really admire the art direction and, you know, the combat, while sort of very easy, does seem like very mechanically satisfying. Like, they clearly focus test the hell out of these games. Mm. And so I freely admit, and great commenters, that, like, I may just not, in my several run-throughs of the first 5 hours of that reboot, I might not have given it a fair shake yet. And maybe I need to try Ragnarok, and it, like, changes that a little bit.
It's fine to like different things, though, you know.
And it's fine to like different things. Yeah. I respect that. It's just, it's less my thing.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, you're like obviously motivated by a keen sense of justice, you know, in your work as a humanitarian and a lawyer and a journalist as well. Where did that come from, do you think?
Probably from several different places. I mean, I was very fortunate to be raised by a single mom who had a really strong spirit of public service. So, you know, as you mentioned, she adopted a bunch of my siblings and from really tough backgrounds at that. And that gave me a sense of perspective. You know, it's not easy coming from a background of abuse or sincere deep poverty and then, you know, really trying to wrestle with the emotional consequences and the long shadow that casts. And I got to see a lot of very strong people go through versions of that journey from very different backgrounds. So I think it engendered an awareness of my privilege and desire to give back. There was also a kind of background hum of just Catholic guilt.
Right.
like Calvinist work ethic that I don't even really know where it comes from, because my mom was like, you know, she went through a hippie phase and stuff. And my family, you know, my grandmother was like very Catholic, but also like very boozy and fun. But somehow I wound up with a bit of a kind of hair shirt, like any 5 minute block of time in which you're not actively trying to like help someone, you're an absolute moral failure. And I'm trying to unwind that a little bit.
Right, right.
Have a little balance in my life, because it was getting a little punishing emotionally over time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Right. And I'm interested in that in terms of the video game lens as well, because, you know, video games are so often about, you're presented with a world that's got a bunch of problems in it and you've got to fix those problems, and there's a clear set of things that you do in order to do that, and that can be very comforting, of course, but also perhaps you know, it's a little simplistic as well, because that's not always how the real world works. Do you think spending time in games where it's relatively straightforward to put right the things that are wrong has helped or harmed your work in this world?
It's a really interesting, thoughtful question. I mean, I think depending on the genre, my relationship with that kind of simplistic quest giving it is usually pretty fraught. There are some settings, like in a Zelda game or something, where you excuse it, and sometimes the writing in a game like Majora's Mask, for instance, can be sort of strong enough while embracing that framework of simple quest giving and almost subverting it in the way it introduces emotional nuance and darkness into it. Sometimes I can like it, but generally my default is to, really want that kind of quest giving to be immersed in a more plausible framework and more kind of rich character development. And yeah, I don't know what that says about me. I guess I want to replicate the sense of challenge that I live in outside of games when I'm playing a game.
I'm interested. Did you ever play the Phoenix Wright series?
You bet I did. Yeah. Love Phoenix Wright.
Yeah. As someone with a law degree from Yale, what did you think?
I can tell you, Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney is a completely accurate depiction of, I don't know what nonsense mishmash legal system, because it's also, I played the American translation, which is quite beloved by fans. The first game had like a translator that was very lauded, and it does do a good and amusingly insane job of translating this extremely Japanese script. One of the consequences of which is it's this incredibly Japanese courtroom procedure, like Japanese anime fantasy courtroom procedure. And then it's suddenly set in Los Angeles in the American translation, which I find just so, so funny. It makes absolutely no sense. But yeah, that game kind of tickles my sense of the investigative in video games.
Right.
I love that. And I also, I'm a big fan of, like, Monty Python surrealism.
Yeah.
And that game really delivers that. It's an incredibly goofy game.
I can't remember which Phoenix Wright game it was, but there was in one of them you'd be talking to a suspect in your investigation, and there would be this is an aside, but you just reminded me of it. And they'd have like something that they were lying to you about, but they'd have like three little, it was represented by locks or something, and you had to find the right question to ask that would unlock the secret that they were holding back. And
I believe the lock mechanism came in the second game.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Rhoda. But I was thought that was such a great way to illustrate that idea of like sometimes just the right question just unlock this great.
Yeah.
Obviously that's sort of the world that we operate in, but you're trying to find the right thing to ask, aren't you? To unlock something interesting and enlightening. So I thought that was quite cute how that game did that.
You're absolutely right. It's in a way like a pretty. It's a highly simplified but still pretty sophisticated reflection of the way just conversations and trust building can work.
Exactly. Okay, on that note, we should come to your third game. Now, you've mentioned the studio behind this, From Software. This game's from 2015. Can you tell us about it?
Bloodborne. Love FromSoft. I love their storytelling. I love Bloodborne specifically. I think it's probably, it was my starting point with From's games. So it's perhaps not surprising or a result of bias that it's the one that I love most. But I think I'm not alone in that. I think it's like a pretty popular choice for the high point in their canon. And, the switch to this more Victorian influenced world is really interesting and adds a little pulse to it beyond even what they were doing with the more kind of traditional Tolkien-esque Dark Souls stuff. And it just, it has like this perfect balance of level design principles that they've played with across their games. It's so satisfying unlocking a big long shortcut way back to a distant area you were in long ago every time it happens in that game. I knew almost nothing about their games when I started playing Bloodborne, which is a really incredible way to go in because...
Wow.
Yeah, it did start its own game design tradition. You know, the Soulsborne is like a genre now, and you don't see that a lot in any medium that something does something totally new. I mean, it's exciting whenever you encounter it, even if it like doesn't work totally, and I think it does in Bloodborne's case. But, you know, like when you watch... I'm trying to think of the closest thing in other mediums. If you read like a Cloud Atlas where it's like, oh, okay, we're doing something new structurally, or you watch a, you know, Bong Joon-ho movie, like a Parasite or something, and it's like, oh, this just switched genres three times on me. I think for me, Bloodborne left an indelible impression just because I had never experienced anything quite like it.
Yeah.
And it was very, I mean, talk about games that don't pander to the audience.
Right.
On the original PS4, that game was like hell to play with the load times, and every time you die, it's like, actually, I think before they patched the game, it was literally just like a black and white screen of the logo that you would look at for 3 minutes every time you died. The death of load times is really very exciting to me, and I hope that continues.
Yeah. Kids don't know how good they've got it.
And I love the FromSoft kind of archaeological storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, going back to that part of the discussion, it's really fun to kind of piece together what the lore is in a game like that. Do I wish that there were like a little more kind of active engagement in the plot? Probably. But, you know, that's not what that game is trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, an extraordinary game. Absolutely.
It also does things, by the way, once you get me started talking about FromSoft, I get stopped. It does things like that with storytelling in unexpected places all the time. Like, you know, you wind up with these boss battles that are very like melancholic, and where there's like clearly something troubling going on story-wise.
Yeah,
and there's like in Demon Souls, there's the boss where you kind of like you fight another player, and then sometimes you can get summoned into the game to play the boss. There's all sorts of good creative stuff in there.
No, sorry, yeah, you're dead right. Yeah, Cloud Atlas is a interesting comparison, but I think it works. It's, yeah, structurally, it's doing some really, really new stuff. So, what is it? Just to ask you, if you don't mind, just a few questions about the time when you were reporting on the Weinstein stuff. I think people would be interested to just hear a bit about that. Of course, you wrote a book, Catch and Kill, which everyone should go and buy and read. But were you aware of Harvey while you were But before you started working on this? You know, obviously you grew up adjacent to the world of Hollywood, and had you ever met him before when you were younger?
Only in passing. I think I met him at a couple of like conference type events, and I think I was vaguely familiar with the sort of gawker level, like blind items about a not even non-consensually gropey. I think the way it had always been framed in those anecdotes was like this casting couch culture of like starlets, it perhaps in a slightly obligatory fashion, but ultimately consensually putting out for him or whatever, that you kind of like, it was a trope
right.
In Hollywood that don't take off your top for Harvey Weinstein kind of thing. And like that was out there. It was like Courtney Love, like warning
right.
young actors not to go back to his hotel room in like red carpet interviews. I feel like there was like maybe a Tina Fey joke about it at some point. It was like, it was around, it was out there, which is not to say, I think people look at that and they're often like, oh, well, people knew and they covered it up. There was a smaller circle of people who either knew or should have confronted the extent of violence that was happening. But I don't know that I subscribe to the school of thought that says like everyone who ever was aware of, you know, some of the contours of it or joked about it or whatever, you know, should be held responsible in some way. I think you know, there were people who knew, and then there were people who really knew.
You were working at NBC when you started your investigation. How did that begin? Did someone approach you, or did you go looking for the story?
I had written an op-ed about, like, the press's relationship with sexual violence in Hollywood, and it really touched a nerve. And then I pitched, I had stopped anchoring my daily cable show and was on the Today Show at the time and had an investigative series, and I had pitched a story about the casting couch and this kind of transactional sex culture, which ultimately led me to the Weinstein story, which became something altogether different.
Your first report was published by The New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
Part of the reason for that is because, as I understand it, NBC refused to provide a platform for your reporting. Why do you think they did that?
Well, it's been reported since by Ken Oletta and other journalists who looked into it, and NBC kind of acknowledged and apologized for at least some of this, you know, that they...
To you? Did they contact you directly?
Well, they issued a public apology, kind of because Rachel Maddow said she had looked into it, and it was true that they had attempted to stop the reporting. And then the body of reporting I mentioned from a lot of other journalists who looked into it afterwards, Ken Oletta in his book being the example I just mentioned, showed that they had promised Weinstein at a corporate level that they were going to kill the story and get rid of me, essentially, before any of that was communicated to me. So, yeah, you know, I think it's... the dry answer is it's like it's a consequence of the way these giant media companies work, that when you have a news division, and NBC News has, you know, incredible journalists at it, particularly at a working level behind the scenes, investigative producers, many of whom protested the situation we're discussing here. I mean, my working level producer on this, wonderful journalist named Rich McHugh, walked rather than like acquiesce to a cover-up over it. So, you know, the journalists are great, but the fundamental business model of a giant, you know, multinational corporation with a lot of different holdings that doesn't really see the news division as a pivotal part of the bottom line, you know, brings other benefits. But, you know, as long as kind of the journalistic integrity of the thing isn't the core economic ambition or concern, you know, you're going to have this rich tradition that stretches way back of like big networks killing tough stories to acquiesce to, you know, powerful outside influences. And it's always disillusioning to see a system that goes that way. And this was an unusual case where they kind of had to apologize and acknowledge as much as they were forced to. But plenty of times, I think the public just never sees that, which is unfortunate for all of us.
What was it like for you to know that you had this story and then to feel the institutional rejection of your reporting in that way without really understanding what was going on? What did you feel? Yeah, I mean, how did you feel?
Oh, well, you know, it was a horrific tour through corporate gaslighting. I mean, to sit there and have people say over and over again, as I got more and more, you know, I had more people on the record. And every time it was like, it's just not a story. It's just not a story. No one's ever going to care about this. And like, eventually, you know, you've got to stop. Like, this is going to harm your career, which it did for a moment. And then, you know, thankfully, the public embraced this story and what had happened came out. But I was in an uncomfortable position of like, I kind of had to bet the farm on it. Which is less traumatic than what a lot of the people involved in the story went through, but
of course,
you know, has put me in a fair bit of therapy. And unfortunately, another trait of the network news world is just there's a lot of kind of retaliatory smearing in the press stuff. So the moment you have that kind of a C-suite that's embattled, I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs after this. So I see why it happened, but it's still like very dismaying to have to then cut through like walls and walls of just fabrications. And thank God I wasn't like alone as a corporate whistleblower in that case, because I had this working level producer who had seen everything, seen what we had. So it wasn't as easy, because he wouldn't acquiesce, for them to kind of to misrepresent what had happened. But it's still very punishing to go through that process. And I appreciate that I was able to go through that in all the ways that it's bruising, because I had a much higher profile, a bigger platform than most people who are in those fights. So while it put me into a lot of therapy, my career was fine and did flourish after. But like, I completely understand why if you're, you know, a single mom working in a small regional outlet with a shrinking newsroom and you're in a similar situation, you just don't have the opportunity to maybe fight that big fight and take those knocks and kind of emerge to do more of that work. Like people have to pick their battles and stories do just die. But what a luxury that we're at the New Yorker. The New Yorker is like, they, you know, part of that story is that they came in and saved the thing and immediately said like, no, it's a huge story. Let's like put all hands on deck. And so actually that's a story with a happy ending because there are still these oases in the media landscape where somehow there's like a bunch of people with integrity who make tough decisions reflecting that.
Yeah. Why don't we come to your fourth game then, which is from May 29, and you have already mentioned it a little bit earlier, but tell us about this wonderful game, Space Exploration.
Okay. Speaking of corporate news culture, Outer Wilds. Yeah, good segue. Outer Wilds really, really connected with me because it is like a spiritual successor to that Riven tradition that I talked about, where you're dropped into a world without a lot of hand-holding. It's a similar kind of size and non-linearity in terms of world design versus Riven, which we talked about earlier. And it has that shared ethos of like every puzzle is a part of the plot and every puzzle is really just like part of one or two big puzzles that you solve to beat the game. And that creates an incredible curve of knowledge-based progression where by the end, you're like piecing together these grand mysteries all in one go. It's a, you know, a time loop-based game, as you know.
Yeah.
The way it uses that sort of looping mechanic really lays bare that sense of knowledge-based progression where, like, you're stumbling around in your first few runs, barely able to progress anywhere, and then by the end, you're, like, crossing the whole solar system really, really efficiently because you've just learned so much about the world. And that, I think the storytelling in that game is incredible, too. The use of music is incredible. Really brilliant soundtrack that I listen to a lot. Yeah. And, like, it's in a very Zelda-ish way. Clearly, a game very inspired by Majora's Mask. It's a game that like connects music and character development in a really satisfying way. I think I cried a little at the end of Outer Wilds.
Yes.
I found it like a very interesting and moving testament to like the enormous loneliness of the universe, but also like the shared importance of striving for greatness and progress across a lot of distance between different types of people. The themes, for whatever reason, with where I was in life at the moment that I played that game really, really landed with me.
Yeah, it's like a elegant piece of Swiss clockwork, isn't it, that game? You're sort of pootling around in your little moon lander type spaceship and trying to figure out the mysteries of this relatively small set of, you know, star system or set of planets and how they all work together. And the clock mechanic plays into that. Really extraordinary game, isn't it?
It also has a little bit of a kinship with the immersive sims that we talked about. It's less about like active engagement with the world. You know, you're not like stacking boxes and so forth, but it is a game where you learn a basic set of rules about how physics works. And for each little planet, you're learning a set of predictable rules. And then not so much through manipulating those rules, but through just studying them and gaining knowledge of them, you're learning to play by those rules and build your own solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Incredible
game, yeah. And that's incredible one where game. It makes me a little sad that there's like a little bit of an accessibility barrier. It's like not the easiest game to turn people onto.
Yeah.
You have to kind of learn this slightly simulation-driven way of navigating with your ship. And, you know, once you're in the realm of first-person yeah. games, which tend to be my favorite because they tend to be the most immersive. Not exclusively at all, but I do have a preponderance of those games on my favorite list. But once you introduce people to that, you know, twin stick control system, it's like automatically you lose a chunk of the audience.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you quickly, you tweeted a little while ago about your friendship with the composer Stephen Sondheim, who perhaps most famous for writing the musical West Side Story, for any listeners who don't know. But you tweeted about how he loved video games and that you would discuss them with him. Can you just tell us about that relationship? How did you first meet and find out that you both loved games?
You saying Steve Sondheim is most famous for West Side Story is going to get the music theater gays as mad at you as the God of War stands are going to be at me.
Well, what would you say?
well, that's going to get me into controversy. I think I'm a Sweeney Todd guy.
Okay.
Right. He loved video games. He loved puzzles in general. His whole house and both of his home, he had a place in Connecticut and a place in New York. They were both filled with puzzles of every kind, and he would do like cryptic crosswords all the time, and like wanted to talk about games all the time, wanted to talk about puzzles all the time. He loved Myst, big fan of Myst.
You bonded over Myst,
yeah, and right up until like pretty late in his life, we talked a ton about video games. I think that kind of stopped a little bit in the last few years, but he sincerely appreciated game design. I think much in the serious way that we're talking about it. And you know, had a background, had studied as a mathematician at Williams, and like had a very kind of quantitative background, as great musicians sometimes do. And so I think his appreciation of kind of puzzles and intricate level design and stuff was probably connected to that.
Hey, so did you ever play co-op games with him at all?
No, I never saw Steve play a multiplayer game. I don't know that would have been... His partner, Jeff, I think, did some, like, racing game stuff. But no, I think Steve was more of, like a puzzle guy all the way through. And I do love I love puzzle co-op games. Like I love the Portal games, and those are those probably should have actually been on my top five list,
right?
Because those, as you can imagine, just they mix up all of the different traditions that we're talking about, like rich exploration, incredible art direction and storytelling, and just you know, that I guess it's Eric Walpaw, right? Was like the main like creative driver of that dialogue.
Yes. I mean, I've had him on here.
I can't wait to listen to that. I mean, I love that guy. I think his writing is so great. Big fan of what he did. He wrote on the first Psychonauts too, I think, right?
So great, yeah. Yeah, he did, yeah.
He's just brilliant. I mean, I would love another Portal game so much. I guess that's like old hat for Valve fans. Everybody wants another Portal game.
Yeah, I think he wants to make another one, but it's...
Let him do it, Valve.
Make too much money doing other things.
Yeah, they got real distracted by...
making money.
They don't hate making money off Steam, but make some games occasionally, goddamn. But then, you know, the annoying thing is like I haven't played Alex yet because I'm like still holding out hope that it comes to PSVR 2.
Right.
But but you know, the fact that they do come back and it's like amazing again is, well, good on them.
Bro, okay, I could talk to you forever, Ronan, but we should better come to your fifth and your final game, which is from a little later in the year that Outer Wilds came out. Can you tell us about this game and why you love it?
I think I put Disco Elysium on there. I just thought it would be a different kind of game design to talk about. It's like very, very gamey in some ways, right? It's got this like top-down RPG look and feel and set of mechanics. But the quality of the writing is just so excellent. And similar to what you said about Phoenix Wright and the kind of unlocking different layers of conversation with characters and that maybe appealing to my investigative sensibility and my interpersonal sensibility, I don't know that it always totally succeeds at this mechanically, but Disco Elysium does at times feel like a really interesting experiment in that space of like almost combat dialogue. Deus Ex has like toyed with that a little bit too over the course of that series. I'm very interested in it. I think like it's understandable that a default kind of first set of interactions that games got built around was the kinetic stuff, the running and the jumping and the shooting. But I'm really interested anytime a game comes along and is like, okay, now the basics of how we interact with the world and other characters or enemies in it is totally different. Like now it's dialogue as combat, for instance. And Disco Elysium is just a great showcase for that kind of sensibility because it's so, the writing is so beautiful. You know, the dialogue is so, so strong. And I don't know how they did it, but when they finally did the voice acted version, like the acting is also so strong. And it's like, it's such a rich, unusual world. I know there's been like tumult at that developer since, and who knows what's going to happen sequel wise. But man, anyone who played an important role in the art direction and writing in that game, like, I just want to see whatever they do next.
Yeah. Phenomenal game. Yeah. So Ronin, your perfect console has got Riven, Deus Ex, Bloodborne, Outer Wilds, and Disco Elysium.
What is this hardware? this is a mythical, you can't do those all on one system.
Well, we can now. And we're going to need a name for this product to bring to the world. Can you give us a name for your console that we can use to market it?
Oh my God, this is a pop quiz question. What should it be? It's like, is it a Ronin Cube? Oh, we can do better than that. We gotta workshop this.
I think that sounds pretty good. Ronin Cube.
I always liked the kind of like the internal Japanese like working names for hardware.
Right.
You know, like what was the GameCube like? Oh, well, I guess that was Dolphin, right?
It was Dolphin, wasn't it?
Wasn't one of them like Katana?
Right. Was that Dreamcast or something?
They all have such cool working names. Oh, and I do love the absolutely bonkers Sega naming tradition of like Saturn, Genesis. Maybe I'd pick something biblical.
Yes. Wait, what kind of biblical? That's a widespread.
Yeah, I know. I gotta choose carefully here. Some of it is real bad stuff.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll come back on someday and I'll have a robust console name that is not Sega-esque, that sells better than Sega's names.
Well, if you don't, we're releasing the Ronin Cube, so watch out.
Okay, great. Sounds good.
Okay, just before I let you go, thank you for being so generous with your time. I'm interested, just one last question. Before we were recording, we were just chatting about, I guess, the slight cultural resistance or institutional resistance we both perceive to video games. You know, notably, the New York Times still doesn't have a video game person. And I don't know, that feels a little strange. It feels like an oversight. Maybe in 30 years they'll think it was. Why do you think that is? You were saying that you don't feel it's just part of the fact that video games are still quite young because they're not that young anymore. So why do you think they still struggle?
I mean, I think it is both. I think like there is more appreciation for games as art and as a storytelling medium, and particularly amongst young people, I see, you know, talented writers and artists going into that space because they grew up loving it like we did, and not just loving it, but also taking it seriously when it merits that. I do think there is a way in which the argument around games as art will always be fraught, regardless of how mature the medium is, because it is like, it's a toy as well, right? Not everything is Shadow of the Colossus, right? Like also there's Tetris, and like Tetris is great. Like sometimes these are games that lay bare the mechanical gamey nature of the thing much more obviously. And I don't turn my nose up at that either. I think like a sophisticated understanding of and love for games kind of embraces both. And there are social games and there are more kind of mechanically simplistic games. And then there are games that are about story and character and so on. And all of those have value. I think because of that merger of traits, that they do have more elements of the toy in them, and I mean that in a non-pejorative way, the conversation is always just going to look different than it does around linear storytelling mediums like books or movies.
Yeah, yeah, there's something harder to define. There's that quote from Frank Lance at NYU, who says video games are operas made out of bridges, which I think encapsulates it quite well.
Oh, cool. I love that image.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I think that does encapsulate it well. And look, it's one reason why I find video game criticism and commentary uniquely interesting too, because it's a more changeable, volatile, you know, unformed space to do talking and thinking and writing in. And thank you for your contribution to that.
Oh, thank you. Oh, well, and thank you for this as well. You've been such a thoughtful guest, and I've absolutely loved hearing all your thoughts on these games. So, yeah, I think people will be surprised at quite how knowledgeable and nerdy you are.
That I'm an Annapurna, though. Although, did we wind up with only one Annapurna game on the list? I was trying to restrain myself. I mean, you can imagine, given my taste, I'm just like, you know, I love Kentucky Route Zero, all of that stuff.
They have great taste, are they, at Annapurna?
They really do. Yeah. They really find incredible projects to back.
Yeah, they do. Cool. All right, well, Ronan, thank you. Thank you again. This has been wonderful.
Thanks so much, Simon. Take care.
Thank you so much to my guest, Ronan Farrow. I did know that Ronan liked video games very much. I hadn't counted on quite what an expert he would prove to be. Really incredible knowledge there. It seems like Ronan has spent a lot of his life not only playing video games, but also immersing himself in the culture around them online, on forums, on Reddit, on YouTube, you name it. He seemed to know all of the sites to go to, all of the communities, and just what fantastic knowledge. A warning there, perhaps, to parents who say to their children, you must first read Anna Karenina in the original Russian before I'm going to buy you a Nintendo Switch. Perhaps a warning that if you do that, you're setting your kid up for a lifelong obsession with the illicit world of video games. Although, of course, in no way has it held Ronan back in any way. In fact, judging by some of those conversations, it may even have provided some room for him to explore some of those questioning instincts that he has and that have served him so well in his career to date. Grateful as well to Ronan for opening up a bit about what it was like to report on what became a world famous story. Let's be honest, it's a story about which everyone listening to this will probably know and recognize and remember. And Ronan played, of course, an instrumental role in excavating that story and exposing the violence that had gone on in that situation and bringing some of the people involved to justice. You can read, in fact, more about that story in his 2019 book, Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators, which is a really, really excellent book. And that followed on from his previous book, which came out the year before, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. So check both of those out. You may have noticed during that chat that Ronan mentioned he had added his voice to a virtual reality game recently. That game is Area Man Lives, directed by Amy Noel Green and Ryan Green, who previously produced the game That Dragon Cancer that I'm sure many of you will be aware of. Area Man Lives is described as a quirky VR mystery It's available now on Steam and Meta and other devices as well. If you head to the website areamanlives.com, you can read up on that game, and you can also listen to Ronan's voicing of the character of a local news reporter. You can also follow Ronan on Twitter, and you can see him, of course, on television regularly. He's a fixture on North American TV sets, but he's also has programs available on Now TV and other services for international listeners to this. You can follow me as well, if you like, on Twitter at Simon Parkin. And you can follow the podcast as well at My Perfect Console, with the O's removed, at the Humble Podcast Twitter account. But it's worth following if you would like little previews of which guests are coming up. I release those on a Friday, so if you want a little preview of who next week's guest will be, you can pop along there and listen to a short clip often. If you would like to support the podcast financially, please go to Acast Plus, search for My Perfect Console. You'll find it easily. You can become an early access supporter, and for just £3, $3 a month, €3, wherever you are, it's around that anyway, you will get episodes 24 hours before the general public and ad-free. On that note, if you would like to sponsor an episode of the podcast, just drop me a line on myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Okay, I think that's all the admin out of the way. I will be back next week with another guest, their five games, and one more Perfect Console. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.